Hello, and welcome to Derm Discussions. We have an incredible episode for you today. Your favorite host, Dr. Brad Glick, speaks with auto-inflammatory disorder expert, Dr. John Harris, on new developments in the world of vitiligo and alopecia areata research, as well as what to anticipate in the future. It's a great discussion, and we know you'll enjoy it. If you want to keep up to date on new episodes of Derm Discussions, and the most recent clinical news, follow HCP Live on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook. Now, let's go to Dr. Glick's and Dr. Harris's riveting discussion.
Welcome to Derm Discussions, a monthly webcast from HCP Live and Dermatology Times. I'm Dr. Brad Glick, and I am your host. Today's topic focuses on vitiligo and alopecia areata, and we are truly honored to have with us Dr. John Harris, who is an internationally recognized expert in autoinflammatory disorders such as vitiligo and alopecia areata. A little bit about Dr. Harris. Dr. Harris is chair of dermatology, director of the Autoimmune Therapeutics Institute, and director of the Vitiligo Clinic and Research Center at UMass Medical School. He is a dermatologist and physician scientist caring for patients in a vitiligo specialty clinic and running a research laboratory focused on understanding disease pathogenesis and developing new treatments. His group integrates basic, translational, and clinical research strategies to accomplish this. As a result, early clinical trials in vitiligo have shown success. Dr. Harris founded Velaris Therapeutics, whose focus is to develop an effective and long-lasting treatment for vitiligo, and Nyra Biosciences focused on inflammatory skin disease. John, welcome. Thanks so much for being here with us today. And I want to jump right in so our audience learns a ton about vitiligo and alopecia areata and where we're at these days. So let's start by kind of reviewing vitiligo, kind of what it is, and even alopecia areata, these very important autoinflammatory diseases that we treat, maybe about mechanism of disease and pathophysiology.
Sure. Yeah, happy to kind of outline that to start. And thanks for having me on here, Brad. I have always been interested in vitiligo. My research, my clinic is all focused on vitiligo at this point. But when I was a trainee at the University of Pennsylvania, George Cotsarellis grabbed me and said, "Hey, you're an immunologist and I'm a hair expert. So we should teach you some alopecia areata while you're here." And so I spent a lot of time in his hair clinic. And so when I first came out, I actually saw both alopecia areata and vitiligo. And one of the reasons I was interested really in both is because they both are very similar diseases. So vitiligo and alopecia areata are both autoimmune diseases, which means the immune system crawls into the skin and in vitiligo finds a pigment-making cell and kills it. So then you get white spots. And in alopecia areata, the immune system crawls into the skin, finds a hair follicle and attacks it and makes the hair fall out. So it's pretty much that simple. The diseases really are driven by what are called CD8 positive T cells or cytotoxic T cells. Those are the parts of the immune system that can kill your own cells. And usually their role is to protect you from viruses or tumors. And in this case, they're choosing to attack your own cells and cause disease. So vitiligo, white spots, alopecia, areata, hairless spots, and they're very similar. And I actually wrote an editorial, I think in 2013, saying vitiligo and alopecia areata, apples and oranges. But in the sense that there was a comedian that said, you know, we always say apples and oranges, that they're so different. Actually, they're pretty similar, right? They're both fruit, they're both sweet, they're both citric acid-based. And so in many ways, they're very similar diseases.
You stole some of my thunder because in doing some prep before interviewing you, I actually looked up that article. So I appreciate you bringing that up. That's great. Couple of things before we move on. You know, cytokines over this last 20 plus year are really part of our lives in dermatology. What cytokines are potential targets for alopecia areata? I mean, I know we have therapies that are coming and it's very exciting. But as we, you know, talk about targets and we have biologics for now atopic dermatitis and 11 of them for psoriasis, are biologics going to be part of the wave of the future for these two diseases? And what are the cytokines?
Yeah, love them or hate them, cytokines are important. And a lot of people hate them because they make the boards harder, right? I, in the recent past, helped write questions for the boards, and you know, cytokines are great fodder. And the reason is because they're great targets therapeutically. They really are central to driving disease. And if you shut them off, it disrupts the communication of the immune system that needs to coordinate to cause the inflammation that we see in the skin. And so clearly psoriasis, right? You said 11 biologics, starting with TNF-alpha and then to IL-17 and IL-23, you can inhibit, it's fascinating that you can inhibit a single cytokine, a single protein, and completely clear people of their disease for a year, even, right? Even 100, a PASI 100 is not that unusual now. In atopic dermatitis, you know, you target just one cytokine receptor, the receptor for IL-4 and IL-13 with dupilumab, completely shuts off disease in a huge number of patients, takes away itch, clears up their skin. So clearly cytokines are important. We and others have really described the role of interferon gamma in driving alopecia areata and vitiligo. Angela Cristiano in alopecia areata and then also in vitiligo with our work and others. So that's important because there are no biologics right now on the market that target the interferon gamma signaling pathway or interferon gamma or its receptor. There is one, but it's used for an unusual disease and has some side effects. So we can't benefit from the drugs in psoriasis and in atopic dermatitis to treat vitiligo. So one of the drugs that does target the signaling pathway, though, not a biologic, but JAK inhibitors. So interferon gamma signals through JAK1 and 2. Ruxolitinib blocks JAK1 and 2. Tofacitinib blocks JAK1 and 3. And both inhibit interferon gamma signaling. And so early studies, first by Brett King in alopecia areata and vitiligo, separate patients showing tofacitinib was effective. We used ruxolitinib in a patient in collaboration with Angela Cristiano and showed that it reversed his vitiligo and alopecia areata. And then really based on those very small observations, much larger studies have now been done showing great efficacy of JAK inhibitors in both diseases.
So before we move on, and I have some more specific questions, can you tell us a little bit about your lab, what's going on in the lab? The research, obviously, it's in these two areas. Tell us about that and maybe some other interesting research that's being conducted. And then we'll move on to some of the specifics of AA and vitiligo.
Sure. When I was a student doing my thesis, PhD thesis, I was studying type 1 diabetes. And I was always frustrated at the fact that we couldn't study humans. We were always studying mice or cells in the dish. And that's because the pancreas is just so hard to get. We learned in medical school, you don't mess with the pancreas. So you can't biopsy, you can't get at it. And so it's really hard to study in humans. And it was a patient with type 1 diabetes and vitiligo that really fascinated me. And I said, I can study vitiligo and understand autoimmunity. I can have access to the skin. And so I've always wanted to do what we now call bench to bedside or translational research. And vitiligo let me do that. So I became a dermatologist, vitiligo expert. That was my passion. And now the lab really uses basic science. We have a mouse model of vitiligo. We use translational science where we are able to get tissues and blood and other, you know, tissues, skin from patients with vitiligo and study that. And then we do clinical trials. And the goal of the lab is really to seamlessly integrate all of those three things, basic, translational, clinical science, to better understand the mechanisms of disease. And so we became early fans of cytokines and chemokines. Those are soluble mediators that you can target therapeutically. And so the lab has been focused for the last 10 to 15 years really on understanding vitiligo pathogenesis. And we, you know, the early descriptions that interferon gamma played a role, Brett King cited in his first paper, it was tofacitinib, a pathogenesis-directed therapy for vitiligo. And he said it was because I read your paper and I realized that it might work. So we gave it a shot. So the lab, you know, it's full of people, clinicians, dermatologists from all over the world, undergrads, MD-PhD students, PhD students, all kind of at all levels, really working together as a team to understand vitiligo at a high level.
As a clinician practicing in the trenches, in addition to doing some teaching myself, I just want to say how much people like myself appreciate the work that you're doing, because our patients can't get better without this kind of amazing work.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, it's so much work. I think a lot of people don't, you know, unless you've done it, you don't appreciate how frustrating and difficult science is. I'll show one slide that's a summary of 12 years of work, and it just makes my tears well up in my eyes.
Yeah, and then to take that, which take years and years, and then finally to get the drug to market too, is a whole nother conversation as well. Let's segue to a lot has been made about the microbiome, dysbiosis, and its impact on immune-mediated diseases in general, and certainly in our specialty of dermatology. What about the microbiome, dysbiosis, and these two disease states, whether it's vitiligo, alopecia areata, or both?
Yeah.
Tell us.
The microbiome is incredibly complex. It makes my head spin every time I think about it, because there are so many different subspecies of bacteria and even viruses and fungi that just live with us normally. And their early studies showed that if you got rid of the microbiome and you incubated mice in the absence of any bacteria or infectious agent, the immune system just didn't develop correctly. So those commensal bacteria that we know and love really are part of the education program for our immune system. Our immune system, I think, practices on them and it kind of develops and gets to become a normal immune system. And in the absence of any infection or commensal bacteria, et cetera, the immune system just doesn't develop correctly. So it plays an enormous role in immunity in some way. You know, our ability to fight viruses and potentially even when it goes wonky and causes autoimmunity. But the details we still don't know. I think it's so complex that it's very hard to understand exactly how it's working and how, you know, a disrupted microbiome could then result in X, Y, and Z. And I kind of equate it to, you know, diet, right? Our diet probably plays an important role in every part of our life, but really dissecting it is so difficult because everybody's diet's a little bit different and it influences them in a little bit different ways. That said, there are some studies that have shown that disrupted microbiome, particularly in the gut, can affect both alopecia areata and vitiligo in mouse models. That hasn't yet translated to an understanding in humans, but I have no doubt that eventually we'll, not we, but investigators will be able to figure that out.
So let's jump into the heart of the matter. I think we've gone over these disease states and your explanation's been great and efficient. What about what we have in the toolbox right now, which I think most of our colleagues know, but what we have now, but yet what's coming, when do you think it'll be in our hands? You know, we talked about JAK inhibitors a little bit already. There's been a little bit of a blockade to them actually being released in our space for atopic dermatitis, which is very disappointing, probably because of one particular JAK inhibitor and some of its consequences. But where are we now? Maybe take one disease state at a time, your passion, vitiligo, what therapies you use on a fairly regular basis, what works, what doesn't, what's coming. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a pill or an injectable therapy, even some mechanical treatments, phototherapy, et cetera. Your thoughts?
Yeah, one thing that's fascinated me is that vitiligo has been treated effectively for 3,400 years, at least. We've got ancient medical texts from India and Egypt. In India, the Atharva Veda and the Rig Veda actually describe vitiligo and exactly how to treat it. And fascinatingly, the Vaidya, the medicine man at the time, would tell the patient to go out and pick these black seeds called babachi seeds or babchi seeds. And the seeds, they would chew on the seeds and then sit out in the noonday sun until they sweat. And then that would be the treatment. Then they'd go inside. And it turns out the babchi seeds contain sorolin. So believe it or not, they were using Puvasol in the Iron Age, India. And it worked. And they kind of recorded it. So fascinatingly, we only rediscovered that by Ilmafti in the 50s and then Fitzpatrick and Lerner in the 70s, the Puva was kind of rediscovered, right? But it was an Iron Age treatment and worked for vitiligo and then rediscovered in the 70s for vitiligo patients. And we used that for a long time. It's effective for vitiligo, but unnecessary. We've now discovered that narrowband UVB is just as good or better, but doesn't cause any of the side effects that the skin cancers and things that PUVA therapy does. In fact, I'm still seeing patients from those docs in my vitiligo specialty clinic now with PUVA lentigines that were induced by using PUVA in the 70s. So now we know a little bit better. We have a little bit safer treatments. Narrowband UVB is very effective for vitiligo. I think it's sad that a lot of my patients tell me that I'm the fifth or sixth dermatologist that they saw. All the other ones told them there was nothing that could be done for vitiligo. And so they went without treatment for decades. And finally they come to me and we put them on narrowband UVB and they get better. So we do have effective treatments. Narrowband UVB is the best we have right now, I think. We also use topical steroids, topical calcineurin inhibitors in combination. If the patients have really active disease and it's actively spreading, we'll put them on oral pulse steroids. I like to use oral dexamethasone, 4 milligrams, just on Saturday and Sunday. And that prevents the vitiligo from spreading while we're waiting for the phototherapy to kind of kick in. Aside from that, you can use excimer laser if it's very focal. That's another good treatment. But if it's very stable disease and rather focal, we can use transplantation. So we can transplant pigment cells, melanocytes, from one part of the body to another part of the body. And that's called, we like to use melanocyte keratinocyte transplantation procedure, where we take a little thin piece of graft, piece of skin from the thigh or the buttocks, digest it with trypsin, pull it apart into a single cell suspension, and then just kind of drip it on dermabraded vitiligo skin, and that heals in and it actually works and looks great. But only a small number of patients can be treated that way because the disease has to be very, very stable. If it's not stable, we can't use that.
You said you dermabrade before applying that. We've been doing some microneedling as well too. Has that been utilized as well with the same intent?
So dermabrasion, laser ablation also. Microneedling would have to be done at a pretty high density. So Fraxel laser, for example, 10% won't be enough to prepare the area. So it's got to be pretty well ablated, not 100%. So if you were going to roll, like use a microneedle roller or something and do, a lot, a number of passes, then that might be sufficient as well.
Tell us your vast experience in using JAK inhibitors, whether it's topical, systemic, in vitiligo, where we are right now, and where we're soon to go, kind of what the future holds in that regard.
Yeah, so it all started with an observation by Brett King at Yale, giving tofacitinib to a patient and watching it get better. And then we gave ruxolitinib to a patient with alopecia areata and vitiligo in collaboration with Angela Cristiano, and that got better. And then David Rosmarin at Tufts said, hey, maybe we could throw this to a cream. And he gave that to 11 or 12 patients and they got better. And then Insight said, hey, wait a minute, maybe this is an opportunity. So they actually conducted a phase 2 clinical trial in 157 patients, a number of different doses, as well as vehicle control, placebo, and noticed the phase 2 clinical trial worked great too. Patients got a lot better in phase 2. So then that prompted a phase 3 clinical trial in 600 patients all over the world. And that hasn't been published yet, but the company released that the phase 3 looked very much like phase 2. Phase 2 we published in The Lancet last year. And so all the details are out there. Phase 3 looked like 2. So the only thing left now is to submit the paperwork to the FDA and seek approval.
And hope there's not continued blockade, even for a topical, for atopic dermatitis, which for me is very disappointing, where we really need therapies as well. Shifting over to alopecia areata, and what I'm learning in my time with you this evening is that there is a lot of back and forth between those two disease states. But, compared to vitiligo, which at least for me as a clinician has been challenging at times, although there is some decent therapies if you stick with the patient accordingly, alopecia areata, depending on severity, seems to turn around sometimes pretty quickly, intralesional corticosteroids, but not always. And sometimes you just can't stay ahead of it. So what does the future look like there as well too? And talk about JAKs as well and any other therapies in your experience that might be available that would be beneficial to our listeners.
Yeah, so the challenge with alopecia areata is that the inflammation's at the bulb of the hair follicle, and that's pretty deep. And so in my experience, I know others have reported benefit. I haven't really seen topicals do much. Topical steroids, topical calcineurin inhibitors for alopecia areata just really have been a challenge. As you said, if you inject them, intralesional ILK, is very effective, you know, for small areas. And I actually used to, before JAK inhibitors came out, I used to inject the entire scalp of some patients. You know, patients with totalis got a couple hundred injections, and we got pretty good at doing that. And that can help. It's just hard when you've got that much. The injections are painful and they're not long lasting. And as you said, trying to stay ahead of it is a big challenge. I used to use a prednisone taper. So 60, 40, 20 every 2 weeks, and then 20 every other day. I learned from George Cotsarellis, and that can be effective in about a third of patients, that they kind of hold their hair, they regrow it and hold it at that alternate day dosing, which is a lot better in terms of side effects than the daily dosing.
Why not dexamethasone pulsing like you do for vitiligo?
So for vitiligo, it takes very little steroid, fortunately, to hold it in place. And actually, the steroid doesn't reverse vitiligo. All it does is prevent it from continuing to spread. So we only use it in very active patients. We can get away with very low doses with pulse steroids. With alopecia areata, you really have to kick it over. And so we had to use very high doses to kind of get it started. And then once the hair started growing, you could then pull way back and kind of keep it in a subpopulation of patients. And then, you know, now JAK inhibitors orally. So topically, JAK inhibitors failed. Topical JAK2 trials in alopecia areata were stopped without efficacy. But oral JAK inhibitors work both for alopecia areata and vitiligo. And that was part of the argument I made in that editorial that I wrote before these things came out. You know, I said, look, both diseases should be treated by the same drugs because they're driven by the same process. The difference is that vitiligo is way at the surface and can be treated by topicals, and alopecia areata is way deep and can't. So we use topical steroids, but injected steroids. If we could use orals like JAK inhibitors, they should be able to work for both, and they do. So tofacitinib works for both, and ruxolitinib works for both. It's just the location of the inflammation that dictates, you know, whether a topical will work or not.
Incredibly fascinating with both diseases. So from some of my reading and even seeing some patients clinically where I've tried some of these therapies, both topically and systemically with having, well, actually two systemic therapies baricitinib available, at least for RA. One of the things I've noticed is that when you have patients on therapy for a while, like some of the other chronic diseases we treat, when you remove the drug, sometimes we get recurrence, whether it's both of these conditions, but it's been in my view that we see this with alopecia areata. What is your experience there in terms of longevity of treatment, withdrawal of the drug, time to recurrence? Do some patients get complete remissions? Tell us about that as we look to the future with having these in our toolbox and what we're going to tell our patients.
I'm glad you asked, because this was my question too. You know, why do these diseases relapse? And I guess, as you said, we probably shouldn't be too surprised because most diseases relapse when you stop the drug. If you have high blood pressure and you take a blood pressure medicine, it works as long as you're taking it, you stop it, your blood pressure goes back up. Same thing with psoriasis too. And the same thing happens with JAK inhibitors as far as we can tell. So the patient I treated with oral ruxolitinib who reversed everything, as soon as he stopped the drug, the vitiligo came roaring right back. There was a publication in 2015, Thierry Passeron in France reported that if you take a bunch of patients with vitiligo, make them better, then stop their drug, the relapse rate is 40% within 1 year. And so, you know, actually that means 60% don't relapse in a year and they get more than a year's worth of benefit. So that's great. But most patients eventually relapse. This is an example of an observation in the clinic as a physician that really informed our research. So we wanted to know that why that was. And not only does vitiligo relapse in alopecia areata too, but a relapse is in the exact same place it was before. I don't know if you notice, if you stop the drug, vitiligo, yes, comes back, but it comes back in the exact same spot first. If you had a spot on your left forearm, it's coming back right there first. And that indicates that there's some memory there, right? How does the skin remember that vitiligo used to be there? So when you stop the drug, it comes back there first. And so scientifically, we wanted to know, what is that memory? What's that autoimmune memory that's forming in the skin, and how can we combat that? And so we weren't the only ones asking this question, actually. Three other labs around the world asked the same thing, and we all published our papers within about a year, year and a half, finding the same thing. So those CD8 T cells, those cytotoxic T cells we talked about in the beginning, go into the skin, they kill the melanocytes. And after they're done and they're satisfied that they've killed enough and they don't want to do any more, most of them leave the skin or they die, but they leave a few cells behind as memory cells. Those are, we call them resident memory, because they glue themselves into the epidermis and they actually never leave. They just sit there waiting. Now, this is important for viral infections. If you get a viral infection, you want those memory cells sitting there in case the virus ever comes back. But when those autoimmune resident memory T cells are sitting there and the melanocytes try to come back, they're there waiting for them and they immediately kill them. And they recruit other cells to kind of bring them in and be even more efficient to kill them. So this is the source of memory. When you take a drug, like whether it's prednisone or topical steroids or light or JAK inhibitors even, they put those memory cells to sleep and allow the melanocytes to regrow or the hair to regrow. But the cells are still sitting there. And so you stop the drug, they wake back up and they reinitiate the disease in the exact same place. So we published a paper in 2018 describing resident memory along with the others. And then we also found that these cells depend on IL-15 for their survival. So we found that if you block IL-15 with an antibody, a biological therapy in the mice, not only does the vitiligo get better and repigment completely, it was a beautiful response, but then when we looked in the skin, all the resident memory T cells were gone. Unlike JAK inhibitors, when we give JAK inhibitors to mice, everything repigments, but the resident memory T cells were still there. So this suggested to us that maybe a biologic blocking IL-15 signaling could be not just a good treatment, but a long-lasting, like durable treatment, so that the memory is erased from the skin. And when we tested that in mice, we found that was the case. Just short-term treatment with IL-15 blockade gave us long-term results. And so based on that, there's a clinical trial ongoing right now, testing IL-15 blockade in vitiligo. I actually started a company called Valeris Therapeutics. We're making an antibody against the receptor for IL-15. And we're hoping that this will be the next best thing. You know, as psoriasis got better and better over 25 years, JAK inhibitors are just the tip of the iceberg in vitiligo, and we're very excited that they work. And we've now got it. We'll probably have the first FDA approved treatment for vitiligo with a topical JAK. Oral JAKs probably will come behind that, but there are lots of safety concerns about JAKs. They're not durable treatments. So maybe IL-15 biologic will be the next kind of big step forward.
Incredibly exciting. I want to end just with a topic that's been quite important in our specialty of dermatology, and of course this past couple of years and certainly going through a pandemic, just in general, your comments about patients that suffer with vitiligo and alopecia areata, just their access to treatment, healthcare disparities, kind of your perspective, your opinion on that, and particularly since there's not been a lot in the toolbox, how that's kind of impacted this group of individuals. And of course, they're so blessed to be able to have clinicians like yourself dedicated to treating these conditions. But there's not a lot of you out there. And most of us that are practicing dermatology, we want to treat these patients, want to get them better, but it's been a big challenge. So what are your observations on that as we close?
Well, first of all, for your younger listeners, and actually any listener, if you're looking for a subspecialty and looking to specialize and find a niche, there's no better time than to become a vitiligo expert. And alopecia areata expert, right? So this is, imagine being a psoriasis expert 30 years ago when Enbrel first came onto the scene. It's been a great ride. You know, it's super exciting. As you said, there's 11 biologics to choose from in the toolbox. The toolbox is rich. It's fun because you see patients get better before your eyes and they're all thankful. And it's just a great time to be a psoriasis expert. I would project that, but the same thing is about to happen in vitiligo. So the next 20, 30 years is going to be a whole lot of fun to be treating vitiligo patients. But until that happens, we're using the same treatment that they were using in the Iron Age, right? 3,400 years ago, we haven't changed our treatment. And so we need to do a lot better. We're going to get there. And phototherapy, as you alluded to, is not an easy treatment. So access to phototherapy is not simple. You have to have a dermatologist's office nearby that offers narrowband. Even if you have that, you have to find a way to get away from work or school and get it into your schedule. It requires two or three visits a week. That's not easy. Because of that, we've used more and more home phototherapy. So there are companies that sell home panels that actually work great. And I've got hundreds of patients on home phototherapy. So that helps with access. For me in Worcester, I have people from all over the world who come to see me. And some of them are flying from the other side of the earth over here. Some are coming from Northern Maine, and there actually aren't any dermatologists in Northern Maine, I found out, certainly that don't offer narrowband UVB. And so they just had no options. They'd have to drive an hour and a half away to get phototherapy. And so home phototherapy has been a great option for them. So in terms of trying to make sure that we can treat everybody, it certainly isn't easy. And home phototherapy right now is mostly an out-of-pocket cost. So you know, patients who don't have the means can't participate. And that's tough. The hope is that with new FDA-approved therapies, we'll have much better options for patients that can be prescribed from anywhere. You know, if we have a biologic therapy that only has to be administered a couple times a year, that would be fantastic, right? So access wouldn't become an issue anymore. Just making sure that insurance companies agree to pay for them and support these patients, it's important. A lot of times people try to get away with calling vitiligo and alopecia areata cosmetic diseases, right? And some of us, my colleagues in dermatology have said that. Remember, cosmetics are things that happen to everybody. Wrinkles, gray hair, like that. We're all going to get them. We all deal with them. If you don't want them, you pay out of pocket to deal with them. Vitiligo is an autoimmune disease, and so is an alopecia areata that affects 1% of the population and causes psychological damage that's equal or greater than other diseases that we treat all the time. So there are some nice quality of life studies that show that vitiligo patients are even more affected than psoriasis and atopic dermatitis, believe it or not. So they deserve treatment, and they deserve to have their treatments covered just like everything else.
You know, it's a really great place to end. And I would share at the end here that we do a fair amount of eczema laser in my clinical practice for treating patients with vitiligo. And I find it astounding that a number of payers here in Florida where I practice actually sent us letters indicating that patients with vitiligo are experiencing a cosmetic problem, not a medical one. And I find it incredibly disappointing. And we fight the fight for them. We start to send them pictures. We tell them how it's impaired their quality of life and how it's disfigured them over time. And the medical aspect of it that payers just don't understand that this is a real medical condition, it becomes incredibly disappointing for me.
Agreed. Thank you for doing that. That's important.
Yeah, there's no question. I can't thank you enough. This has been incredibly educational, enlightening for me. I'm sure that our listeners will enjoy the information that you provided. I really appreciate you taking the time to not only educate myself and all of us here at HCP Lion Dermatology Times, but everything that you're doing for patients that are suffering both with vitiligo and alopecia areata. So thanks again. And I want to bring you back again when we can talk about the fact that we have interleukin 15 inhibitors in our toolbox and when these JAK inhibitors come to market, and we'll bring you back and we'll talk about all the patients that are having successes with these therapies.
That's a deal. It's been a great, thanks for the opportunity, Brad. I've been very happy to be here.
Once again, we'd like to thank Dr. Harris for joining the program and for his invaluable insights into vitiligo and alopecia areata. If you like this episode of Derm Discussions and you want to hear more, follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook. Stay safe, stay healthy, and you'll hear from us soon on the next episode of Derm Discussions.